OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 136 of Sign Language. A couple of weeks ago, I saw on my Facebook feed a post by one of the guys who's an engineer at the Australian Radio Network, where I work. Now, when I say engineer, I don't mean recording and mixing engineer like me. I mean broadcast engineer, the guys who, you know, keep the transmitters running. A guy called Joel, lovely guy. And it was a link to an Orban product. And for those who've worked in broadcast, you'd be familiar with the name Orban. They do on-air signal processing units for the broadcast arena. And this is a unit that's made by Orban, and it's called the Omnia 9. And I don't know what prompted Joel to post a link to it on his Facebook page. I assume because we've had one in the station and he'd been mucking around with it. What's really interesting about this particular device is it aims to undo the damage done by extreme brick wall peak limiting, which, you know, as all of us who have bemoaned the loudness wars over the last 10 years know, is, you know, the one of the most heinous crimes committed in the world of audio processing, and yet it has been the most ubiquitous crime in the history of audio processing. You know, every CD that's been released in the last, you know, 15, 20 years has just been slammed through, you know, progressively more and more aggressive peak limiting. And the whole idea of the Omnia 9 is that it, you know, obviously using some very clever algorithms, manages to undo that. Now, in the past, I've mucked around with using downward expansion to try and undo excessive amounts of compression. And I've had varying degrees of success with that. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, you take your wins when you can get them. But I thought it was just really interesting. I went and had a chat with Joel about it, and he said that he was really impressed with what this thing could do. And essentially the idea is, well, just to backtrack a step, Orban have become famous for their multiband compressors and automatic gain controllers, which will analyze all of the content coming out of the on-air studio of a radio station in real time and modify that signal so that everything goes to the transmitter at a consistent average loudness. So, you know, it's sort of RMS leveling as opposed to peak leveling. You know, and the Orban processors that do that stuff, they do that very well. And obviously what the Omnia 9 has been designed to do is to try and undo the damage of excessive peak limiting prior to sending all this stuff to the transmitter. And the one of the things that's linked to from the article, I'll post all the links, of course, as I always do, from the Omnia 9 page, is a link to a paper that was written by Frank Orty and Bob Orban, which, gee, I don't know, this must be at least 10 years old now, if not older. Well, actually, yeah, it's got to be older because this was featured in Bob Katz's Mastering Audio, The Art and the Science book, which was published in 2002. So, yeah, so this obviously predates that. So it's been around for a while now, but it's a great article. And if you haven't read it and you have any interest in this, do yourself a favor. It's maybe 9 pages of about a 14-point font, so it'll probably take you 15, 20 minutes to read it, with diagrams and everything. And basically what Frank and Bob discuss in this particular document is what happens when excessively peak-limited material hits the processing chain in a, you know, normal radio station chain of processors, you know, because it's not just one processor. If you've ever seen a radio station's control room, you'll see there's, you know, heaps of units that the signal passes through, and it gets pushed and pulled and mangled in so many ways you wouldn't believe it. And having an input which is already excessively peak limited actually does more damage to what comes out at the other end than if you were to send in a signal that still had a whole bunch of its dynamics left in place but was, you know, maybe 20 dB softer. It would still come out as loud, but without sounding so crap. Anyway, it's an interesting read, and if you haven't already read that article by Frank and Bob, I highly recommend it. Again, link will be in the show notes. So that was the first thing I wanted to cover, and of course the Orban Omnia 9, which, you know, then essentially is designed to undo that, so that what it can feed to the rest of the on-air chain is something that actually has a little bit of its dynamic restored, and it, you know, judging by the screenshots they've got on the page, does a pretty damn good job of salvaging stuff that's been heavily clipped. So probably not much interest to, you know, those of us who have quote-unquote bedroom studios, because it's certainly not within the budget of most people. I think these things are up in the sort of 20 grand mark. but, you know, maybe it's a sign for the future that, you know, if the loudness war doesn't correct itself, then, you know, maybe this technology will eventually filter down to, you know, the masses in, you know, the form of plugins and, you know, software that will just decode this stuff on the fly, you know, when you play your MP3s off your phone. Who knows? We can live in hope. So that was the first thing I wanted to cover. The next thing I saw, this was only a couple of days ago, and it was really amazing. This appeared on Science Daily, and the title of the post was "Acoustic Cloaking Device Hides Objects from Sound." And you'll need to read this. This came out of Duke University. I'll read the summary. Engineers have demonstrated the world's first three-dimensional acoustic cloak. The new device reroutes sound waves to create the impression that the cloak and anything beneath it are not there. The phenomenon works in all three dimensions, no matter which direction the sound is coming from or where the observer is located, and holds potential for future applications such as sonar avoidance and architectural acoustics. Go and check it out. Amazing. I mean, not that I have heard it in action, but, you know, if the claims are to be believed, it's a very interesting development in, acoustic cloaking, I guess. Not that I knew that was a subject, but it makes sense that someone would have been working on it. But yeah, very interesting. The next thing I had was something that appeared on the Facebook feed for Audio Technology, which is a magazine published here in Australia for recording engineers and, you know, home enthusiast recording types. And this was about a week or so ago, and it was called Introducing Bitwig Studio, which is a new piece of software, which I've just noticed is actually being released today as I'm recording this, March 26, 2014. And the blurb on the front page says, "We're very proud to announce our upcoming product, Bitwig Studio. It is the result of passionate musicians wanting a more natural way to create music and sound. Bitwig Studio is a multi-platform music creation system for production, remixing, and performance, with a focus on flexible editing tools and a super fast workflow." So they've got a few videos on their homepage. Actually, got quite a few videos on their homepage. I didn't realize there was quite that many. Judging by the graphics, it looks like it's kind of a little bit of a mishmash of everything we've seen, you know, like your Fruity Loops and, you know, any good multi-track, you know, package like Reaper. But also some stuff that's a little bit Reason like for those who are familiar with Propellerhead's Reason, and there's what was that other thing? There was a piece of software, I think I did speak about it years ago in the first round of sign language, I can't think what the thing was called. It was like a modular type of audio creation tool, and it didn't look like any normal DAW. You just had all these little square boxes, and it was like a flow chart where you'd link things together. And yeah, this Bitwig Studio looks like it kind of has borrowed a little bit from that sort of methodology, and maybe even the UI to a certain degree. So anyway, yeah, it's released today, and it'll be interesting to see what it looks like. I'm going to go and have a look at some of these here videos and see what the unique quirks are. But, I mean, I'm very happy with Reaper, and I, you know, can't see myself jumping away from that. But, you know, always keen to see new things and see what's going on. So, yeah, check it out, bitwig.com. But the link will be in the show notes if you want it. And the last thing I had, and this was an absolute pearler, this came up on Tapop a couple of days ago. The title was "The Possibility of Subconscious Auditory Effects in Audio Workers: A Case for Renewing Humility and Wonder in the Field of Professional Audio." I have to confess, this article actually made me sit back and think about my prejudices a little bit. The guy who's written this, Alan Farmello, has basically addressed the idea that as working audio professionals, we take it almost as a given that there are things that we hear in a mix, your nuances that we pick up on, that we understand that 90% of the population would miss, you know. And it's because of the fact that we do this for a living, you know, and that, you know, we've trained ourselves to listen to things very acutely. In fact, he actually goes on to discuss the idea of, what do you call it, global listening versus... might have been focused listening. I can't remember the terminology. I did read the whole article. I just can't remember what these phrases were. But, you know, about that idea that as audio engineers, we train ourselves, you know, when we first come into the industry, like everybody else, all we do is we global listen, which means we just, you know, we listen to a piece of music and we just enjoy the music for what it is as a complete piece. But as we develop our skills as audio engineers, we learn to focus in on and listen to just, you know, what the guitars are doing, or what the bass is doing, or what the drums are doing, or, you know, and we learn to focus our attention, you know, whilst the entire mix is hitting our ears, we just learn to focus on one particular element of the mix. But anyway, what his entire premise is for this article is that we take it for granted that there are things that we notice in a mix that the majority of the population would miss. And yet, at the same time, we have a tendency to be a little bit derogatory towards, you know, the hardcore audiophiles, you know, who, you know, it might be that they spend stupid amounts of money on speaker cables, or they spend, you know, crazy amounts of money on this, that, or something else. And his argument is, why are we so keen to believe that we can hear things that the majority of the population can't, and yet we then disregard the possibility that audiophiles maybe are perceiving things that we don't perceive? It's a very interesting read, and there were some absolutely brilliant moments in there, things that really jumped out at me at the time that I read it, and I really should have copied and pasted those bits so that I could have addressed them. I didn't think to do that, but it's a really good read. I highly recommend it. Quite a lengthy read, probably take you half hour, 40 minutes to get through it, but a really good read. And he has four requests, and I'll just quickly summarize the four requests. Request number one: when talking about a blind ABX test, please add a qualifier, such as measuring for conscious recognition or measuring for subconscious effects, so that we know what kind of test was done. Now, that statement on its own is probably not going to mean much to you until you've actually read the introduction to the piece, but I highly recommend that you do that. Request number two. Please respect your colleagues who are willing to ask questions about subconscious auditory effects, and please don't confuse the results of conscious blind ABX tests with evidence that subconscious auditory effects don't exist. Request number three, when deciding to bow out of conversations about the threshold of perception or about subconscious auditory effects, simply state that you're not that curious about those topics. Try not to imply that those of us who do engage in these conversations are doing something negative. Number four, try to remember that even as an expert... And request number four, try to remember that even as an expert audio worker, it is not only okay, but also a sign of scientific integrity to ask open questions based on curiosity and wonder, even when those questions might run up against the grain of current dogma. There's a lot more to the article, and I highly recommend you give it a read. It was a really good, to me, an eye-opening read, because I will confess, I have been in that boat where I have at times in the past been quite condescending, shall we say, towards, you know, the audiophiles who, you know, go on and on about, you know, this technology versus that technology, or this speaker cable versus that speaker cable, or, you know, the quality of this preamp over that preamp, and you know, the kinds of things where you just go, the law of diminishing returns has got to kick in here at some point. You know, like, you're spending stupid amounts of money for, you know, what could at best be called a, you know, a negligible increase in quality. But, you know, he puts the argument forward quite lucidly that, you know, who are we to say that we hear everything? You know, that maybe audiophiles are actually experiencing something different, yeah, through changing their speaker cables. You know, who are we to say that they're not? You know, so yeah, it was a very interesting read. Very interesting read. Highly recommend it. I received no emails in the last couple of weeks, so either nobody's listening or nobody cares, or you're happy with what I'm talking about. So, any comments, please jump on in, send me an email, buzz me on Facebook, leave comments on the blog, whatever you prefer. That will do it for this week, and until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotu.com.